A word about listening and receiving the Dharma talks. The Dharma talks, the teishos, are in an important way a direct presentation of the essence of the thing itself. You are invited to receive the talk in the posture of your zazen, listening not just with your ears, receiving not just with your mind, but with your spleen and spine and heart as well, letting it in allowing words to in part point to that thing that is fundamentally beyond words. And a word about the koan that we'll read. This is a PG-13 koan and features scenes of seeming violence. And I want to frame for you to listen to this not as a literal report of a past happening, but listening to it and hearing it in the same way that the pre-Disneyfied Grimm's fairy tales sometimes present powerful and shocking images. And this, the emotional quality of that can serve to underscore the importance, the urgency, the thing that requires such vivid care that it perhaps couldn't be expressed any other way. And so, case three of the gateless barrier. Juji raises one finger. Whenever Juji was asked a question, he simply raised one finger. One day, a visitor asked Juji's attendant what his master preached. The boy raised a finger. Hearing of this, Juji cut off the boy's finger with a knife. As he ran from the room, screaming with pain, Juji called to him. When the attendant turned his head, Juji raised a finger. The boy was suddenly enlightened. When Juji was about to die, he said to his assembled monks, I received this one finger Zen from my teacher, Qianlong. I've used it all my life, but never used it up. With this, Juji entered into his eternal rest. Master Wu Men's comment. The enlightenment of Juji and the boy has nothing to do with the end of a finger. If you can realize this, then Qianlong, Juji, the boy, and you yourself are all run through with a single skewer. Powerful and provocative. In this teisho, you'll be hearing from each of the three teachers leading this retreat. For my part, I want to begin by talking about this great teaching of Juji, this manifestation of Juji's great faith, this demonstration of Juji's capacity to receive all arisings into the same one container. This is our practice of Zazen and Shikantaza. Juji is responding in some ways to a line from the heart of true entrusting. that says to us, immediately affirm, not to. Whatever anyone brought to Juji, he immediately affirmed, not to. All of this is included. This too is it. This too is part of the universe, the one thing that is the universe and you, universe and youing. This is this moment, including all of its confusion, all of its fear, all of its doubt, all of its understanding, non-understanding, clarity, calmness, agitation, pain. All of this points to just this. Only this one thing. The universe universing. Just this is it. And we so want to find the exception to that. Sure, just this is it. But obviously what you mean by that is when I feel calm and clear, then just this is it. Just this is it. But not if my knees hurt, right? Just this is it. But not if I don't feel great about the koan presentation I just made in Doksan. Then that's not it, right? But Juji, such a paragon of faith, such a paragon of not getting caught in delusive distinctions, responds to all arisings with just this one finger. Robert Aitken says that we can also read this word always. He always responded with one finger. We can read that a little flexibly too. But we can imagine that even when he was not responding with one finger, he was responding with one finger. Even when he responded by eating rice and drinking tea, even when he was serving or was served by a monastic in Oryoki, he was demonstrating this one finger. Each moment of zazen, upright and unmoving, is that finger. Or perhaps each moment of your zazen is the cuticle on the universe's finger. Somewhere Dogen says that all of us are accoutrements to the universe. Accoutrements to the universe's oneness. Forms taking differentiation as expressions of oneness. Immediately affirming, not to. This is a powerful, powerful tool, a powerful sword that cuts through everything, cuts everything in the universe into one. This is Manjushri's sword, Juji's finger, cutting everything into one. He used it all his life. There's another teacher who whenever he was asked a question, would turn and face a wall. And there is value to turning and facing a wall. I don't love that teaching as much as I love Juji's finger. Although perhaps even if he always turned and faced the wall, perhaps he can turn and face the wall without turning and facing the wall. Turning and facing the wall of grieving when it's time to grieve. Eating when it's time to eat. The one finger. Oneness with choosing what is? This is what liberation from all obstructions, the poem we read today, emphasized. Choosing what is enacting oneness, embodying oneness, embodying this one finger. This one finger's end. This one finger's end is utterly reliable. Utterly, utterly reliable. Jiji received the one finger's end from old Chan Long. And perhaps all of us can receive the one finger's end from Jiji, from Wu Men, the compiler of the Gateless Gate, from all the generations of women and men, named and unnamed, have passed down this one-fingered Zen to us. So this is one piece of the koan, and my co-teachers will illuminate further pieces.
So I will start by talking about Jiji before he was the paragon of not getting caught. And there's a story about him that precedes the koan. And in this story, he lived at a time of great persecution of Buddhists in China. And so he fled to the mountains, living there in a shelter, and begging for food in a way so as not to be seen. And he was a very sincere student. He poured himself into his zazen and into studying the sutras there alone in his mountain shelter for a long time. And one day a nun appeared at his shelter. And she is given the name True World. And she appeared with her hat on. And it was traditional then when one greeted a monk or an adept to circle the monk three times, which she did, but she kept her hat on, which was a sign of disrespect. So this old nun had some thoughts about Jiji right when she saw him. And she circled him and said, "If you can give me one word of Zen, I will take off my hat." And Jiji, he couldn't respond. And she circled again and said, "Just give me one word of Zen, and I will take off my hat. I will show you my respect." And Jiji stayed there in zazen posture. And then yet a third time, and as she got ready to go, Jiji shouted, "Stop, wait, you could stay here the night." But she wouldn't stay. She left him. And after that encounter with this old and fierce nun, this old and fierce bodhisattva who arose from the cracks of Jiji's mountain shelter, he went into deep despair and shame. He went into a dark hole, a black place. He had spent so much of his life devoted to this practice and truly believing that the forms that he was embodying were his manifestation of the one true reality. And yet along comes an old nun, and he can't say even one word in response to her question. And he decides to give up. He decides he's going to pack up and go on pilgrimage. But he has a dream that someone is going to come the next day, and so he waits for this person to come. And along comes Chan Long. And in that encounter with Chan Long, he appears despondent, ashamed. He says he's not a man. That's what he tells his teacher. And Chen Long's response isn't to give him a hug or pat him on the head or tell him to just go back to sitting. Chen Long's the one who raises the single finger. And in that, Zhu Ji breaks open like that chick that comes out of the cracked shell. But this is not Zhu Ji comes out of the cracked shell just at some random occurrence. This is Zhu Ji who has spent years and years devoting his life to what he believes is the one true reality, who has gone into the depths of the black hole, and he is feeling like the world has been pulled out from underneath him and he has nowhere to go. And in that moment, when he has nothing, that is when the single finger Zen shines forth as the brightness of the world. So the single finger Zen, he embraces it as his own. It is not Chen Long's single finger. It is Zhu Ji's single finger, because he knows it for himself. He has drank the tea for himself. He has eaten the rice for himself. He knows what the single finger is. And with that, he can go forth into the world and always, as Josh was saying, whether he raises the finger or sits in Zazen or has tea and rice or talks to old nuns with hats, it's always with him, this single finger, because he discovered it for himself. It is not an imitation. It is not someone who sits like a stone that the old nun found, sits like a stone and studies the sutras. This is someone who has really proved to himself that there is no ground and he doesn't need any ground. So when the teacher comes raising the single finger, it need not be a teacher Chen Long, need not be Josh or James or Diane or anyone. The teacher could be the sun rising in the morning, and that is the single finger coming up for you, for me. When we have abandoned all our ideas of who we are and what is the right practice, then we can open our hearts and our minds and our full body experience of living to what appears. And whether it's the breeze blowing the branches or the sun rising or knowing that the person sitting on the cushion next to us is so sincerely practicing in unity with this one thing that allows us to drop away all our notions of who we are and join in that one thing together. So, Zhu Ji, before he becomes the paragon and the paragon of not two, many of us can feel for that Zhu Ji, and he gets to replicate it with the young attendant later, when he is the teacher and the young attendant is in the place of Zhu Ji. And so now to James to take you further into the story.
So, for me, this koan has so many places to enter, and one of the things that comes up for me is is again about intimacy in this one finger Zen world, intimacy in the form of the one mind, the one body, awakening from this delusion of separation, and intimacy in relationship. So intimacy in this world of moving around in relationship with others. Gigi found himself this wonderful, fully embodied presentation of the way. We sometimes say, how many different ways are there to say just this is it? How many different ways are there to say just this is it? But boy, we've come up with a lot, right? but Gigi preferred a sort of simplicity. Just this one way of saying just this is it. Even when he chose another way of saying that. Robert Aitken, when he's reflecting on this koan, imagines that Gigi, in the story that Diane just told, had somehow convinced himself that he could attain the heights of understanding, reach out and touch the face of God, sitting alone in his hut, dedicating himself wholeheartedly to the single practice of Zazen. And of course there's something to that. But then, you know, here she comes into his hut, true world. The true world of other people. The true world of relationship. She circles him three times and stands in front of him and says, "Say something. Say something." And he is baffled. Caught back on his heels. Can't say anything. She gives him another try, right? Quite lovingly. Okay, all right, I get it. You know, I just burst in here and you weren't ready for me, but you know the game now. Let me do it again. Once more around the monk. Stand in front. Say something. This was unexpected. This world of oneness, this radical intimacy, this communion with God, I wasn't really expecting other human beings to show up and show me disrespect. This true world. And so this is our practice in this true world. As we do our best here in this room, on this session, to clarify the heart's eye. The eye that embodies, that deeply understands the most fundamental truth of the universe. That there is no separation. That we are all woven from the same cloth. As Josh says, we are in this moment the universe universing. In the entire history of this universe that you are in this moment on this cushion, nothing has ever entered or left the universe. And so the invitation to really make contact right now here on your seat with this moment of the young monk trying to explain to a newcomer what his teacher's teaching is by holding up a finger and Juji calling him into his room and cutting that finger off. A dramatic exemplar of what it's like to be in an intimate relationship. To embody this vulnerability. And sometimes the teaching of the world hurts. Sometimes the teaching of the world damages. What arises at this moment in your heart? What arises at this moment in your mind? As we encounter others who cut our finger. How many different ways are there to say, just this is it? That this radical intimacy includes this radical intimacy. Where do you see two? Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so the person radically, dramatically, terrifyingly cuts you off in traffic and slams on the brakes. And you lay on the horn, and he raises the one finger. True intimacy. What arises in your heart, what arises in your mind, that is actually the Dharma. That is the universe universing. There is no separation. Giver, receiver, and gift are one thing. Intimacy with others in a world, in a universe where there is no separation. What is outside and inside and in between? The Buddha is said to have offered in his last moments, be a light unto yourself. What is your one finger Zen today, right now, with this breath and this heartbeat and this great love? Thank you.
So now I invite you to sit comfortably and we will have our Dharma dialogue and please come forward with your one finger. Cindy.
On my way driving north in the car, at one point I just let out with a scream and some tears and just let it loose. And somehow I felt better by acknowledging the wanting to flip the bird back at, you know, circumstances of my life. If I don't allow that, I'm really stuck with it and really hooked. And I get glimpses of that, and I get some ease from situations by sitting on this cushion for the weekend. And I didn't really run away. It's all here. But I get to just watch how I play with it when I'm not here. And I don't necessarily like what I see. I haven't got that one word to say when not sitting here on this cushion. I'm just so grateful for the opportunity to observe at the moment, if I'm not necessarily comfortable. It's better than sitting with any number of circumstances. Work frequently is you know, the driver flipping the bird at me. But
gratitude.
I keep wondering whether to get off the road, but you know, I don't know if you're here.
Yeah. Yeah, well expressed, Cindy. And so the bad news about the road of Zen is that the point of no return comes pretty early. Getting off the road, not so much an option.
And the road's always under construction.
Damn. To put it politely.
So, I loved hearing about Juji's younger life. Yeah. Thank you for that. And, I was also struck with how the attendant just kind of, you know, he has this awakening experience and then he just kind of disappears and we don't hear about him. He's not in our ancestry dedication. You know, we never hear about his no finger. So I was thinking about him and I was thinking how there's a temptation for me to get that part wrong and to think that I need something cut off. I need to lose something. And I wondered if you wanted to talk about that temptation.
Well, I'm tempted to say you do need to lose something. you know, it's the thing that is pointed at with these phrases like the bottom of the bucket drops out, or the compassionate light of our true nature shines through the cracks in our delusion. You know, this conviction that we inherit and carry with us really for our whole lives that there are two things in the universe, me and everything else. You know, catch even momentary glimpses of that clarify that, you know, to see through that delusion just for a moment you know, we find our way to the foundation of our salvation. And, you know, I hear the part that feels like something otherworldly has to happen. You know, the miraculous powers of a well-lived Zen life are, you know, eating rice and drinking tea.
In my mind, there is an invisible appendix to this koan, in which this boy, this attendant, who we don't hear of. But one question I have for you, do we not hear of him? Do we not know about his no fingers then? But that at the end of his long life, when he's 90 years old, lying on his deathbed, head of his own monastery, he holds up the stump of his finger and says, I got this one finger Zen from old Juji, and I've used it all my life and never used it up. So bring your no-fingered Zen to Dokusan.
And just to, I'd like to question, maybe think about this more, you know, that we have this conception that we need to lose something. We need to lose a finger, right? And it's, I think, not up to us to do the losing, you know? Right? It's, you know, Dogen talks about forgetting the self, you know? We think that we need to do something to forget the self. And if we could just do that, then, you know, everything would work out great. But this losing, this forgetting, this is the kind of mysterious power of the universe, but our sitting in Zazen, our wholehearted practice, you know, it's often said, makes us prone to the accident of losing. So not our business to be in charge of the losing, but something there for each of us, right? Like when you said it, I just went, so thank you for that spark of reminder. Yeah.
Thank you all for this talk. I just wanted to say what struck me deeply was how searching for the word. How intensely Juji engaged with incredible intimacy this feeling broken, this feeling alone, this feeling separate from everything. And sure that he had completely failed as a human being. And there it was, right in front of him, being exactly who he is in that moment, or who he was in that moment of, I have failed as a human being. This is a feeling that I have from time to time. It arises this way for me, that I have completely failed as a human being. And it comes and it goes. And when I heard the story, so easy to think engagement with that set of emotions, that part of the emotional field, is not it. Or that that the emotional field is separate from what is, all that is. Your story alone, you did things differently.
This is from a, this is kind of like far afield here, but I was reading about Stephen Hawking, because as many of you know, he died this past week, you know, and his discovery of, you know, black holes, and also his discovery that at the end of his life, that so black holes, right, the most contracted place in the universe, right? So not just, I mean, it puts us to shame, a black hole. and he discovered that they explode. They do not stay contracted. And even in the contracted place, particles of energy and matter are at the surface. So this sense of no matter how contracted I feel, no matter how Juji felt, ashamed, you know, and pouring out his heart to this teacher he never met before. I mean, he must have felt terrible to do that with a complete stranger. He must have been really at the lowest point. But to have some kind of faith that even in that most contracted place, there's little sparks at the surface, you know. So to, I think that practice gives us that faith to be with everything, whatever it is, and there is energy there, and there is no need to be in charge of. You can't tell the black hole when to explode. You don't know when it's going to happen. You know, it's just a force of nature. So just we're forces of nature too.
So I think another lesson in this koan is the temptation to confuse what is real with the teacher. And it seems to me that that's what the attendant was doing. Mm-hmm. He was imitating the teacher rather than knowing for himself. And I think it's such a it's such a risk for us in Zen, because our practice does encourage us to to really invest our trust in the teacher. And it's easy to confuse the teacher with reality. And, you know, I think if we have to lose something, that's one thing we need to lose, is that confusion. That we have to own it for ourselves. It's not our teacher's then, it's ours then.
Well said.
There's a, I'm not remembering, I think it's Shantideva that it's attributed to, but basically something like, you know, when all Dharma teachers have, you know, left the earth, and all the Dharma teachings, you know, have left, you know, like, whatever, thousands of years from now, and there's just like no Zen left, right? It's just evaporated, you know. Everything is still teaching the Dharma. Hmm.
Yeah. And Zen encourages you to put great faith, great trust in the teacher. But don't imagine the teacher is this guy. you know, I think it's Keizan who says, don't slander Shakyamuni by saying he taught the Dharma. Don't imagine that he was teaching. And so what is the teacher that is utterly trustworthy? What is the teacher that is, unfailingly reliable? And it's nothing so small as a human being. And one of the things, and this is such an important theme. My first teacher, John Dutta Lori, was so powerful and charismatic. It was like a power he exuded in the room, especially when he was giving Dharma talks, and it was so compelling. And the challenge of that, and he himself would say that a charismatic teacher is good for the organization and very hard for the student. And so the challenge for all of ourselves was to not fall into the mistaken belief or the mistaken aspiration of I want to be like that guy. And the heart of Zen is becoming more and more like our true selves. Putting our faith in the reliable teacher of the universe, of the Dharma itself, of Zazen itself, of this moment itself.
One of the things that seems to suggest for me is that perhaps one of the worst things that could happen in your practice is to never have your teacher fail you.
Right. We will be vigilant to make sure that doesn't happen.
Let's see. I think did Jillian, and then just did you have your hand up?
Yeah.
Okay.
Along the lines of, you know, the fingerless one. I had this, there's this resonance about if not now, when?
Mm-hmm.
And this student, I mean, there had to be maybe this, I mean, you really pretty much have to let somebody cut your finger off. If you think about it. But it's pretty instinctive to just completely hide your hands and, you know, and then, you know, so there's this, it's like such a painful receiving of something. And then you go off and, you know, it's pretty immediate that you can't do things the way you've been doing them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if it's metaphorical for us, or however you would use a word there, it really feels like a, you know, feels like that leap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you heard the saying from Chogyam Trungpa that it's like jumping out of an airplane and finding out your parachute doesn't work, but then you also discover there's no ground? So that is the leap.
Then. Yeah.
Uh-huh. But for you, when you're saying about, you know, he must have sort of offered his finger to be cut off. You know, like your sense of it, that it would be instinctive to pull away, right? But sometimes life cuts off your finger, right? It's just as painful, right?
Yeah.
And you weren't offering yourself to it. You know, it wasn't at least, you know, conscious offering. So I think just to be a little aware that we get our finger cut off. We get enormous pain, not by our own doing. It is just a part of being alive as a human being. So, and then what do we do with that loss, right? Where do we go from there?
And I appreciate your naming that in that moment of cut off. If not now, when?
Mm. I think we have Justin, and maybe that'll be for a while.
Let's see.
Did I miss somebody up in the back? Oh, Leilani? Didn't you? Okay, Justin and Leilani. Yeah.
Mine's quick. I just wanted to, going back to the comments on teachers, appreciate the organizational style of Boundless Way that has so many teachers. I find it helpful to kind of disentangle the one true teacher, the Dharma, from the personalities and I love all of your personalities, but having so many teachers I think it would be easier to conflate those two if there was just one teacher. So I just wanted to say that I'm thankful for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I use the image of the Venn diagram, like in each of the teachers is one of these overlapping circles, and there's areas of overlap and non-overlap. And if you just have the one circle, you can't tell what part is the Dharma and what part is the teacher. And so, yeah. So what is the one thing that all of the teachers teach? Thank you, Justin.
I feel like I'm encountering this koan like I encounter all koans, which is with great confusion. And not knowing. And it's not even just the content of it, it stirs up a lot of different arisings for me. A lot of judging, for example, like, man, Lalani, there's like three teachers telling you this thing. Everybody else here seems to be getting it and giving like really heartfelt feedback. And you're like, what is this? And that's how I felt like about Mu, about hand sounds. And now like chopping off a kid's finger, and it's just this judgment. Like I have judgment about my lack of understanding and judgment about the koan. And then what else is arising is this real desire to know things, real desire to like, I just want answers and I want clarity and I guess that in and of itself it's good to see good to see what is arising, but it's a struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You sound to me a lot like how I imagine Juji sounded after the nun walked around him three times. You might have said those similar words, huh? Felt similarly. Like, and it's so wonderful that you make the koan personal, right? These are not historical accounts. These are about our life, our personal encounter with the Dharma, and for you to bring it in that way. So critical, even though painful.
Well, one of the things that I find so interesting about the practice is this opportunity to, as you're saying, observe these arisings, right? To like notice the arising of the judgmental mind, right? And all the sort of work that thing does. And that, like, you know, I also seem to notice that I'm not doing it, right? Like, it's just sort of happening. And the mind that wants to achieve, the mind that wants clarity, the mind that wants to like get somewhere else, right? That feels better, I guess. You know, and the bodhisattva opportunity, you know, in that spot to recognize that judgmental mind is all of our judgmental minds. And so the arising of the heart of compassion, right? And that one that's trying to get somewhere else is, you know, all of our one that is trying to get somewhere else. And so, oh yeah, me too, right? You know, in the same boat. And the arising of the part that takes it personally. You know, the part that thinks that I'm doing this or this is me. You know, I sometimes have the image of like how films, they probably don't work this way anymore, but used to work, where it was just like, you know, one picture and then another picture and then another picture, and they would just go by the lens fast enough that it looks like movement, mm-hmm. right? But it's like judgmental mind, oh, that's me, you know, the mind that's achieving something, oh, that's me, but they're like, mm-hmm. they're just two separate arisings, but they're happening so quickly next to each other that it seems like, oh, that's my judgmental mind. Mm-hmm. But there's like my and then judgmental mind. and then my, and then shame, and then my, should be doing better, and then my, right? And so, you know, we take it all so personally. Yeah.
So, thank you. Wonderful dialogue and wisdom everyone shares with each other.
We'll sit together a couple more breaths, then go to Kinhin.